an Italian tour guide wants you to wander away from the tourist crowds when you're in Venice.
Don't forget, it's an island. You cannot get that lost.
Or you can sell your home and travel the world. Michael and Debbie Campbell thought it would be a great way to enjoy retirement. They share what they learned for the past 12 years in case you'd like to give it a try.
Plan, but don't overplan, and allow room for serendipity.
Well, we had to learn to treasure experiences over possessions. That is the key to our success.
After he explored the world for a few years, Philadelphian Kenny Dunn went back to Europe to start some of its first neighborhood food tours. He wants you to sample some rare treats next time you're in Paris.
I'm going to introduce you to something which is the marriage of a croissant and an eclair.
Take a food tour, hear what's new in Venice, and the senior nomads come home. It's all in the hour ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. Find out what's new that visitors in Venice need to know in just a minute. And in just a bit, the senior nomads return to share what they've learned from 12 years of living around the world and to let us know they've come home. And a founder of a network of local food tours across Europe tells us some of his favorite treats you can look for in cities from Amsterdam to Athens. That's all coming up in the hour ahead on today's Travel with Rick Steves. The great city of Venice, for centuries the hub of a vast trading empire and a European superpower, was founded way back when Rome was falling, and it was just grew up in the middle of a vast lagoon. The idea was to escape the chaos of the power vacuum created by the end of the ancient Roman Empire. But today, Venice doesn't escape the chaos of the modern touristic world, that's for sure. It attracts it. And a challenge for travelers like us is to see Venice, but to also get away from those touristic mob scenes that plague so many travelers' experiences in Europe's most popular destinations. Venice is working hard to manage its crowds, and any visitor needs to be up to date on the city and have crowd avoidance as a sightseeing priority. On my last visit, I was vacationing with my girlfriend, and I booked Igor Skamparin to show us the off-the-beaten-path Venice. Igor joins us today to share the latest on the place he calls home. Igor, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Hey, well, I was visiting with you, and we were looking at offbeat Venice, and we were dealing with the crowds. And there's two things that travelers need to do. I mean, you got to go to Venice. I love Venice, but it's going to be crowded. You got to see the Doge's Palace, and you got to see St. Mark's Basilica. But there are alternatives to these things and little tricks to avoid the crowds. Let's talk about some crowds to avoid and advice for avoiding that. Of course, you can spend half a day waiting to get in to the Basilica of St. Mark's, and you can spend a long time waiting to get into the Doge's Palace. What can we do to minimize those frustrations?
What I say, first of all, with St. Mark Basilica or Doge's Palace, right now, if you're buying Skip the Line tickets, you can go directly in, especially with the new system that we got in the St. Mark Basilica. We got is since July. You buy the tickets online, you book it at the time that is available, you present yourself at the entrance, you show up your ticket, your QR code, and no waiting.
So you walk by the long, long line of people who did not do that. I've long recommended buying your ticket to the Doge's Palace over at the Carrère Museum, which is on the other side of the square, because that ticket includes both the Carrère Museum and the Doge's Palace. Does that still work? You buy your ticket at the Carrère and walk straight in? Or now is it best to buy online at a timed entry?
It's probably better that you buy everything online and pop in directly. And let's say the Basilica, you're not able to buy the tickets on spot anymore since July, but in the Doge's Palace, you can buy on-site, but if you buy online, it's way much better. And so you pop in, that's it.
Anticipating that problem, I was wandering around after dark, after dinner in Venice, just on my last visit, and I saw the Doge's Palace is open. And I learned that, what is it, in the summer on weekends, it's also open late into the evening.
Yeah, Rick, going inside of the Doge's Palace after dark is wow, because you got no people, everything is lit up, and the atmosphere is great. But you're right. And so during summertime, especially during the weekend, the palace is going to stay open until late. So 9, 10 o'clock, it depends. But that is a super special treat because the worst time of the day is early hours. Is very crowded, full of groups, and that might not be super enjoyable. Right. right after that time is a piece of cake.
Now, one thing that a lot of travelers have been anxious about is that you have to pay an entry ticket to get into the city itself. This is just starting to happen now. Tell us, what is the latest news about Venice controlling the crowds by actually charging people to enter the city?
So it's 2 years, actually, that they put an entrance fee ticket. And if you sleep in Venice, doesn't matter if it is a hotel, an apartment, an Airbnb, or whatever, you don't pay, but you must register yourself into the Venice website. They give you a QR code, and as long as you are arriving either at the airport, train station, or the bus and car terminal, you might see guards, policemen, that they ask you for the pass. You just present your QR code, your ticket, and they let you go in.
Okay, so I think it's a 10 euro a day entry if you do not qualify. And this would be during the summer months only, like May, June, July.
That's correct.
I believe.
See.
And during the busy time from 10 to 4 o'clock, something like this. And the idea is to get some money from people who are just day tripping in. If you're spending the night, you're a quality visitor. You're spending a lot of money for the accommodations. You're buying dinner, and they don't want to charge you. So I've never day tripped into Venice. I always spend the night there, so this fee would not apply to me. But I do need to go through the online chore of getting that QR code so I can show when I arrive that I do have a hotel reservation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the worst scenario is they say, nope, you got to pay 10 euros and you're out equivalent of $10.
That's correct. Let's say last minute is 10 euros, but if you pre-book, pre-buy the ticket, is something like 5 euros. But if you decide last minute, is 10 euros.
So this is more and more the reality for travelers. To be smart, to save money, to save time, which is a valuable and limited resource, do things online and do your studying in advance so you know, depending on what city you're going to, what needs to be done online, what should be done online, or what you don't need to do online. Igor Skamparin is a local licensed private guide in Venice. He offers tour itineraries that also include the lagoon and the adjacent Veneto region of Italy, where he grew up in a small town just outside the city. He's with us right now on Travel with Rick Steves to update us on the scene in Venice. His website is tourleadervenice.com. Igor, okay, so when we're going to Venice, you got to see the big touristy stuff, of course. Everything's within a 10-minute walk, so it's pretty right in your face. But then you got to make a point to get off beat. You took me on an offbeat walk, and we actually saw a little square dominated by a giant banana tree. I never knew there was a banana tree in town. And you took me to squares where there were cisterns on the square, and dug into the marble was a little bowl for the cats to feed the cats so they would take care of the rats. There's so many fun dimensions of Venice if you get offbeat. What are your suggestions for an American traveler that wants to see the big things, but then have that intimate moment with Venice without the crowds?
Well, I say, as you always said, Rick, you always said, get lost. It's the best part of enjoying Venice. And don't forget, it's an island. You cannot get that lost.
Yeah, so many people, Igor, so many people are nervous about getting lost. And the fact is, I'm always lost when I'm in Venice. But I always remind myself, I'm on an island and I can't get off. And when you want to find your way, look up on the corner of the buildings, and what do you see?
You got the sign with arrows. They might be yellow, they might be white. And then you got Per Rialto, P-R Rialto, to Rialto, yeah. Bridge, Per San Marco, to San Marco Square, all'Accademia, to the Academy Bridge.
And these are, there's 6 or 8 very important landmarks, and you have arrows that point to those, and that's all you need. I love to get up on a viewpoint to kind of orient myself. There are some magnificent viewpoints in town. Rather than going up the Campanile, the famous bell tower, which always has a very long line, the one right there by the Doge's Palace in St. Mark's, I like to take that little 5-minute Vaporetto ride over to San Giorgio Maggiore, right?
You are definitely right. You go a 2-minute ride, you go on the other side, and there's no line, no nothing. There's an elevator that is going to take you all the way up to the top, and the view is going to be just outstanding, awesome, incredible, because you will be standing right in front of St. Mark's Square that is fully crowded. Actually, you can see all the island of the lagoons. You can see the Alps, the Dolomites. And if you're lucky, you can see Croatia, Slovenia, and those areas.
I was always amazed. You can see the mountains. You can see the Alps from the top of these on a crisp day, especially off-season. I love going to Venice in the off-season. The atmosphere is, in the summer, it seems a little murky. There's a lot of humidity in the air. But in the winter, it's cold and crisp and quite nice. Igor, we're just about out of time. But as a resident of Venice and as somebody who earns his living taking visitors around, what is your take on climate change and the impact on Venice, and what does it mean for the future of the city?
It's pretty scary at the moment. We're expecting to have water pretty much until the first window by 2100. And we started in 2003 and we finish in 2020 to build up a dam, a dike, a sea gate, call it whatever. And the project is called Moses Project. That already sounds interesting.
Oh, I never thought about that. Moses. Whoa. What is it? Why is it called Moses Project?
Because we're splitting the water.
Splitting the water.
See, we're keeping the high tide out of the lagoon.
Well, is there hopes that the Moses Project will work?
At the moment, it's working very good. But we got a bunch of things that there are. We need to fix it. But let's say we already activate the Moses several times, and every time that we lift the barrier up, at least we are dry and we don't have to pump the water out of our kitchens or dining room or living room, and we don't have to buy the refrigerator every 2 or 3 weeks, which is good.
Yeah. You know, when I think about the impact of climate change on the whole world, whether it's for tourists or people who are privileged and live in beautiful places, or who people are very poor and are trying to deal with unpredictable climate, I have to say I'm so sad and embarrassed for my country, because half of the people in our country, when confronted with the reality of climate change, they say, drill, baby, drill. Let's just make more money and pull more fossil fuels out of the ground and let Venice sink. So I just want to right now on this radio show apologize for the lack of leadership that our country offers right now. And I think when we travel and we meet people who are dealing with the realities and the ravages of climate change, that we can have a more compassionate and more human approach to this existential challenge facing not just tourism in Venice, but facing the well-being of all sorts of beautiful people on this planet. And we realize how we're all in this together.
I agree.
Well, Igor, you've got a wonderful niche. I wish you all the best, and thank you so much, and I'll see you next time I'm in Venice, okay?
Grazie mille. Hurry up, we're sinking.
No. Ciao. Ciao, Igor.
Ciao, ciao.
We'll hear how a neighborhood food tour can be a delectable way to get acquainted with the European cities you're visiting in just a bit. But first, the senior nomads are back to update us on how they made it work for the last 12 years to live as temporary locals in nearly 100 countries around the world, and why they've finally come home. They're up next on Travel with Rick Steves. They say home is where the heart is, and Debbie and Michael Campbell decided to take that quite literally. In 2013, at the start of their retirement, they packed their bags and bought a one-way ticket to Europe. Within a few years, they had sold their home in Seattle and were calling themselves the Senior Nomads, sharing their adventures and advice to help others do the same. 12 years and 95 countries later, they finally put down their suitcases and have an official residence once again, and it just happens to be in my hometown, Edmonds, Washington. Michael and Debbie are back with us on Travel with Rick Steves to update us on why it was time to settle down and share what they've learned over a dozen years around the globe. Debbie and Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Rick.
Wow. It's after 12 years on the road in 95 countries, you're back home. What a trip. 12 years ago, did you imagine?
We never imagined. No way.
I think we just forgot to come home.
So how was it that this ended up a 12-year odyssey?
So the first 6 months was a trial, and then we came back for Christmas, and I turned to Debbie and said, well, how did you like it? Should we keep going? And she said, yeah, let's keep going. And so then we headed off the first of the year, one of our sons was getting married 8 months later. We said, well, we should come back for that.
Yeah.
And then after that, I said, well, how do you like it? You want to keep going? And she said, yeah. And then we just bought one-way tickets from then on.
And Michael, your 80th birthday is just around the corner.
Yeah.
And you
yeah.
both look like young and frisky as I can imagine.
That's travel
after
for you.
After all of this travel, it is the fountain of youth.
That's right. Yeah.
More people can do this than realize can do this, I think.
I think it kept us young. I think that's really yeah. important. It kept us healthy. We walk, and we met new people all the time, as opposed to your traditional shrinking Rolodex. I'm using that word
you're right,
on purpose.
You're right. It's hard to imagine your mindset right now, your worldview right now, compared to what you might have done if you were the more conventional Americans that would have just lived to what we call a normal life.
That's really an interesting question, because often we say we went on vacation. It was about the concept that we could live our daily lives in other people's homes around the world for the same amount of money we would spend if we sat in our rocking chairs in Edmonds, Washington.
So that's the arithmetic of it right there. And so you had to figure out, basically, can we afford this? If somebody is dreaming about this, let's get right down to the nuts and bolts. How much does it cost on average per day? Would you imagine you figured that out?
Yeah, I'd approach it in a slightly different way. Uh-huh. I would say it's so individual because there's so many different levels and price points and so
right.
forth. But one way to think about it is to add up your monthly expenses in your home, you know, your electricity bill and all the other things, and you put all that together and you come to a bottom line. You say, well, if we didn't have this house or if we rented our house
yeah.
And we didn't have our cars and we didn't have our car insurance and blah,
yeah.
blah, blah, this is how much would be left over. And is that enough to sustain us on the road at a level we'd like
yeah,
to?
And if you rent your house, you've still got the equity when you come home. So you didn't sell everything and you come home at 80 years old and you're a pauper. Mm. You've got your equity.
But we didn't. We did sell our
you
house.
You did? So you
we
came
did
home
sell
and
we are
paupers.
We are definitely officially paupers.
So you're paupers.
Senior paupers.
But you basically ad-libbed it. You didn't stay in hotels. You stayed in short-term rentals.
Yeah, yeah.
It couldn't have worked if we stayed in hotels, because we were living, as I said, our daily lives. I had to do the laundry.
Yeah.
We ate in almost every meal. We liked to come home. Some days we didn't go out. I mean, we'd play Scrabble. And
this is important, and this is one of your underlying philosophies. You've even written a book about this. Your book's called Your Keys, Our Home. And I love this. Living locally is a different type of travel. Try to live your daily life similar to how you would at home. That's a totally different mindset than when I'm traveling, because every day I've got an agenda and mm-hmm. I'm here just for 4 days and I got to see all this stuff.
When we didn't avoid tourist attractions, but we didn't necessarily seek them out either.
Right. And when you do your own cooking and you're not spending $100 a day to go to these sites, it can be much more sustainable on a small budget,
yeah,
I would think.
And going back to your question about, you know, what does it cost? Of course, you know, it's changed since COVID. And more people are digital nomads, and the price of Airbnbs has increased substantially. But Michael threw a dart. He did some spreadsheets before we left, three different or four different budget scenarios. And he picked an amount to spend per night on an Airbnb, and it was $90.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't know if that was going to work or not. And it worked for years. It just was,
$90 per night for two of you.
When you average it out, now you have to.
Yeah, of course. You could pay more in San Francisco and less in
totally.
Some other place.
So mixing up, you know, Rwanda and Croatia with Switzerland and Norway and staying for 14 days and some 3 days, you know.
And that includes your kitchen. So you're basically living for that plus the price of groceries.
Mm-hmm.
And then your travel and so forth. And I think looking backwards now in the 12 years, it's the hypothesis that Debbie came up with to start with. It proved out. I mean, we did it. We did it for 12 years. And
that's it. You know, for a lot of people, that's just like that's an option. It can be done. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with the senior nomads. Seattle natives Debbie and Michael Campbell have been full-time world travelers since they retired in 2013. Their book is Your Keys, Our Home. You can learn more about their 12-year odyssey on their website. It's called seniornomads.com. So, Michael and Debbie, your trip was 12 years, 95 countries, and you didn't just go to the easy countries. If you were to draw, I imagine you've got a globe where you've colored in every country, and you went to some pretty exotic places. Tell me about some of the culture shock places you went to. What were those exciting sort of destinations, and how did it work?
Well, one of our driving forces is curiosity.
Yeah.
And Michael has always been very curious about visiting all 17 of the former Soviet republics, and we did so.
Wow.
Can I jump in? 15.
Yeah. 15.
Okay. 15.
He's
okay,
facts. Good. He's facts and numbers.
Well, I don't think anybody would have jumped to that.
Anyway.
So 15.
And so some of those were very unique, including Turkmenistan, which is where we went last year as our final stand.
So the stands, now that's almost a trip. You could do the five stands, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's the five stands that were part of the Soviet Union, but then there's Afghanistan that we're not even talking about.
But the ones that, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, I don't know the other ones.
Tajikistan and Turkmenistan.
So you could do those, and I would imagine a lot of Americans would be surprised how reasonable it is to travel in that area.
Absolutely, and if you're interested in history and the Silk Road, there's so much to see and so much history to refresh or to learn about in that part of the world.
Now, you put off going to India for, like, until almost the end of your time. What was it about India that you, were you saving it or were you afraid of it?
It just seemed like it needed more homework, more thoughtful planning, more energy.
Yeah.
Same with Egypt.
Not that they were the least interesting, but you just felt like we got to wait till the right time to do this.
And then we went and did them back to back.
I was that way about India. I even took a class, and that really helped. But India is a particularly rewarding country if you understand the culture and Hinduism.
Yeah, I found it to be very spiritual and beautiful and just so colorful, and the people were so kind.
Yeah, India's my favorite country. Even though there's a lot of suffering and a lot of difficulties, the joy in that subcontinent is just mind-boggling.
I found it palpable, yes.
Yeah. What was your best discovery that you didn't think you'd like that was a little bit of a surprise, like, oh, man, this place, I never dreamed about Indonesia or something like that?
I'm going to say Rwanda. We know a little bit about the country and the genocide, but it's just a teeny little country, and there's a lot of interesting things that are happening. I'm very interested in politics and government, and I read recently, the leader is kind of a favorite son of the West. But maybe all is not as nice as it seems. Yeah. But it is the cleanest country that we visited in Africa. It is incredible.
I hear nothing but good things from travelers visiting Rwanda. And when you see that, you just kind of think, well, there's hope for the world that's mired in so much chaos and conflict.
Yeah.
Hey, there's a whole subculture of people doing this now, I think more than when you started. And your Facebook, you have a Facebook group. And it seems like it's designed, you're almost evangelical about sharing the wisdom that you've gained from the School of Hard Knocks. Tell me, why are you putting this energy into your Facebook group, and what do you hope it can do for travelers who want to be senior nomads?
Well, I started the Facebook group in 2020 because we have a blog and people were posting comments on the blog, and it's not a good place for conversation and communication between followers. So I started a group so that people could start talking about traveling amongst themselves. We're now just touching 19,000 members.
Mm-hmm.
And when we started, I think people knew who we were. Debbie and Michael were the senior nomads. Now I think everyone that's in the group thinks they're the senior nomads.
All right. Well, that's good.
That is good. But the joy is people can search our site. So if you want to know about budgets, there's tons of our members that will tell you exactly what they spend down to the penny.
Yep.
You can search for healthcare. You can search for accommodation. I mean, it's all travelers talking to travelers and people that want to become travelers.
Well, there's a community, and that's what's fun. And you've done it. And it's there's a lot of people that are recognizing, as you did, you could take a look at your finances. You could take a look at your travel partner. And you could take a look at, do I really want to do this? And if it's yes, 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 it's a great thing to do.
One comment that when we left, nobody knew who we were or where we went.
Yeah.
And nobody cared what we did. But the New York Times story that ended up in February of 2015, so that's 18 months after we started, created an awareness of us.
Yeah.
And so what turns out, if you look in the rearview mirror, we inspired a whole bunch of people, which we never, ever imagined we would do because nobody knew. Debbie and Michael, where are they? They don't know. Who are we? So I think that's one of the most gratifying things of our whole 12 years is that we've inspired people.
It's great to be able to do that. Michael and Debbie Campbell wrote Your Keys, Our Home, about their experiences with Airbnb rentals. They bring together a lively group of frequent travelers on their senior nomad site on Facebook.
The Campbells first joined us on Travel with Rick Steves 3 years into their senior nomad adventure. And they updated us on how it was going back in 2022. We provide links to those interviews and to their Senior Nomads Facebook page. Look for the notes for today's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Hey, well, we've just got a little time here, and I would love to kind of debrief you. On your website, you've listed 12 lessons from the road, and they're quite philosophical. And we can't do all 12 of them with our time, but I'd love just to go back and forth and let you share your favorites. Debbie, let's start with you. What's one of those points that you find is really an important takeaway from your travels?
Well, we had to learn to treasure experiences over possessions. That is the key to our success. We sold our home, our boat, our cars, most of our stuff. We kept what fit into a 5x10 storage unit, which we've recently emptied and are having a big laugh about what was it that we've paid for all these years. There have been some treasures, but our philosophy became, if you can't eat it, drink it, experience it, or get somewhere on it, don't buy it. I mean, we didn't, the things that I thought about bringing home, it's like, oh, wait, I don't have a refrigerator, so I cannot put this magnet on the refrigerator.
So eat it or drink it or experience it and don't buy it. I like that. Michael, what's one of your takeaways?
I just think it's so important to be curious, stay curious, and to plan, but don't overplan, and allow room for serendipity.
I just think that's so important. When serendipity knocks, if at all possible, say yes.
Yes.
I don't care if you're tired. I don't care if you were supposed to be here. When you've got an opportunity for this unscripted bit of travel magic, that's what you're going to remember.
Yeah.
A lot of people, they need a little kick in the butt to get curious. I mean, they go back to the same state park all their life. They go back to the same Disney World all their life. They go back to the same gambling capital all their life. They go back to the same beach resort in Mexico all their life.
Well, they're afraid to go around the corner.
But go around the corner.
Around the corner. Go the long way.
Walk 6 blocks inland where local people can afford a house.
Yep.
And get a tostada there, you know.
There you go.
So be curious. Debbie, another one from you.
Lesson number 4 is learn the language of courtesy. And the lesson is basically when words fail, kindness translates. So we have people that reach out to us who say, well, how can I travel the world? I don't speak another language. It's like a kindness, a gesture, a smile, a scribble on a piece of paper, or Google Translate will get it done. And I think what you'll find out is that people have said they don't speak English. If you're persistent and kind, they'll dust off their English.
I've seen that after 30 years of running around Europe trying to make TV shows. And if we're polite, we get stuff done. And if we're not polite and we just stampede in there, you don't get anything done. It's just, there's a decency, there's a respect. And on a practical side, we speak the world's linguistic common denominator, so most people speak a little more English than they would admit.
That is an advantage, absolutely.
Michael, what's another one of yours?
We kept a journal. We started for some unknown reason that first week, and we've been doing it ever since, a daily journal. We write a page every day. We filled 30 books, and we write our expenses for the day. Mm-hmm. And speaking of kind of souvenirs, we tape in receipts or tickets to various things and paste them into the book.
Yeah.
So they're all lined up right now on a shelf, and it's really enjoyable to go back and look. So even if you're going to travel for a week or 2 weeks, in my opinion, keeping a journal is
really
helpful.
That will
be a
treasure.
Yeah.
Debbie, what's another one of your takeaways from 12 years of traveling?
We are much braver than we were when we started out. I'll tell you that. I think people start out traveling and there's the unknown and can we take the metro and will we be able to find our Airbnb and what time does the train leave? And the more you do it, the more you become comfortable with that.
This takes me back to my very first days of teaching back when I was 22 years old. Every time I taught a class, I would start by having everybody write down the fears and apprehensions. I called it fears and apprehensions before their trip. And it occurred to me, people are creative worriers. They're just all alone in the kitchen thinking, what can I worry about on my upcoming trip? And it's just human nature. But once you get over there, we're braver than we thought.
Yeah, and we were brave enough to seek out medical care when we needed it in foreign countries. We were brave enough to go into buildings that from the outside you would say our Airbnb cannot be in this building. We're at the wrong address.
Yeah.
And we weren't. And once you got past that graffiti covered, banged up door in Berlin, bam, you were in a beautiful, beautiful apartment.
We're braver than we thought.
think that's really, really important. And a lot of Americans are more cowardly than they need to be right now. And I don't know why that is, but I'm tired of people saying, have a safe trip. Bon voyage. That's what I would say. Michael, what's your next favorite point?
So not everything is going to go perfectly on every single occasion, every single day. When you miss the train or you left your luggage in the wrong place or whatever happens to you, I think you just really need to pause and say, okay, that happened, and I'm in control of my response, and we're going to get through this. So I guess that means staying flexible is a good way to summarize that.
Be flexible.
Yeah.
And I also think that people are always willing to help you if you're in a bit of distress.
That's important, yeah.
It is important, and it helps you get through a tough time because you can count on people being people, and people are kind.
Well, and I think that was one of your points. You know, if you speak, what was it, learn the language of courtesy and be flexible. I liken it to a skier. I like moguls, but they're no fun if you have stiff legs. Mm-hmm. You've got to bend your knees and enjoy the bumps, and the road is full of bumps.
At our ages, I think no.
Hey, Michael and Debbie, one of my favorite takeaways from your travels is your favorite thing to pack along. Tell me what that is and why.
It was on a whim, but we packed our bed pillows. They are now souvenirs, if you will. They're flat.
Yeah, but you can cuddle up to that pillow
sure
anywhere
can.
In the world.
And wherever we laid those pillows, we called home. And so that was really special for us.
Debbie and Michael Campbell, thank you so much for inspiring us. Young and old. We're all going to be senior nomads someday, God willing. And we can take advantage of your experience and your love of travel.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Debbie and Michael Campbell tell us more about how they settled into each new place they were living around the world during their 12 years as senior nomads. And they tell us where they'd like to go back. That's in an extra from today's interview, which you can hear with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. One of the ways they got to know a city when they arrived was to take a local food tour. Up next, the founder of a network of local neighborhood food tours across Europe joins us to explain how they work, to provide a taste of the places you're visiting. Kenny Dunn from Eating Europe joins us from Rome. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. When traveling, you can learn about the culture through museums, and you can learn about it through the local taste treats and street food. And food tours, that's the kind of tours that teaches culture via the kitchen. They've become a hit for curious and adventurous people traveling anywhere these days. I've had tours lately in Medellin, Colombia, in Havana in Cuba, Marrakesh, Morocco, Nice in the south of France, Porto in Portugal, and I've enjoyed so many tasty memories. A typical food tour takes, about 8 or so travelers on a 4-hour route, stopping maybe by 6 or 8 hole-in-the-wall shops to sample local taste treats. I'm joined today by Kenny Dunn, and he's the founder of a company called Eating Europe, one of many hard-working tour companies doing these kind of tours, and I want to learn more about this experience, and Kenny's here to help us out. Kenny, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I did my best to describe what a food tour is in general terms. Would you define that a little differently, or what do you think?
I think you defined it quite well. I would maybe just emphasize a couple other points. I mean, I think one of the real benefits of doing a food tour, as opposed to spending that $50 or $100 on an expensive meal, is you're going to get to try, let's say, 8 or 12 different bites of iconic dishes, some lesser known ones, visiting, as you said, 6 to 8 different places. So if you only have a few days in a city, what a better way to maximize your time than doing a food tour.
And you're already likely to spend close to that in a dinner where you're
exactly.
sitting down
yeah.
and you're having three courses or something. So it's kind of a splurge. On the other hand, it's I just think it's a multifaceted kind of experience that I really like. Now, how long have you been doing these tours?
I've been doing these tours for 14 years,
14
since 2011.
Years. And I don't remember food tours being a thing very much before that. When did they start and how have they grown?
So the history of food tours, there's someone in New York, a company called Foods in New York. The owner is Todd. He's credited with starting them back in 1999.
Okay, I wonder.
So 26 years ago.
So it's as old as this century.
Yeah.
I love the way you say Todd in New York, because I get to meet all you tour operators and so on around Europe, and it's a small world, and people know, oh, yeah, so-and-so in Berlin was the first one to do this, and oh, those kind of tours, you know, that originated in London, and you got the double-deckers, and you got the cooking schools, and all this kind of stuff. And the point is, people are more interested in experiences these days, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think a food tour, as you kind of talked about, it really gives you a taste of local life. You know, it weaves together so many different elements. So it's so much more than a food tour, because it's part kind of historical tour, often, you know, lesser known sites, part culture. And then, of course, the main event is the food.
Now, as you learn and develop the tours that you offer in your company, you must be aware of what all the competition is doing. And I'm fascinated by the competition, because when I update my guidebook, I try several different food tours, and I'll kind of think which one structured best for my travelers. And I like the food tour that hits a number of little hole-in-the-wall artisan shops, rather than sitting down to a nice white tablecloth restaurant and being served and talking about the more formal setting. It's not a qualitative difference, because that can be really great also, but it's just what I'm looking for in a food tour. How would you explain the different kinds of food tours that somebody might encounter? Different companies with a different philosophy of how we're going to share this experience. What distinguishes different companies?
Yeah, I think one of the kind of distinguishing factors you just hit upon. Some are more kind of grab and go street food tours. Others are more of kind of a mix of sit down locations with some kind of street food bites along the way. Some of the other big differences, first of all, are geography. A lot of food tours are based on neighborhoods. So different companies might focus on different neighborhoods or parts of a city. And then, of course, you have different thematic tours. You have companies doing chocolate tours or pastry tours, some that are focused more on the drinkables you mentioned, you know, in London, gin, or in, you know, Edinburgh, it might be whiskey. So those are some of the defining qualities.
It's a good way to tackle a neighborhood. Like when I think of Rome, I think of Monte, I think of Trastevere, and I think of Testaccio. These are three great neighborhoods, whether you're on a food tour or not. And they've all got a pride. They've all got a sort of a cool food culture. A lot of small business, entrepreneurial people. Monte might be more new school, and Testaccio might be more old school.
Absolutely.
And it's just, you're smiling when I talk about this, because it's just in London, East London is the place for a food tour, I would think. In Barcelona, you got the Boqueria Market, which is just too slammed with tourists now. And I think food tour companies are fleeing that, because you can't even stand up in the market. It's so crowded. But trying to find the Boqueria in a less crowded, less touristy zone, which exists, Santa Caterina Market is just kind of the obvious one, and the others beyond the cathedral. So when you are shopping around for a food tour, you look for the neighborhood you want. You look for, I like to know how many stops. More stops is the better. I want some exercise. I want to be walking. Will people generally get an expate, an American or a Brit or an Aussie speaking English with an English-speaking tourist, or will they get locals?
I think it's really a mix, and I think both can be great. You know, your local tour guide is going to be able to tell you how the city has changed, you know, maybe reference their grandmother's, you know, dish, their grandmother's famous, you know, pasta dish.
On the other hand, an expat will have an easier connection with you culturally.
Absolutely. An expat can give you that kind of expat perspective, and I found I am an expat, but I found with some of our expat guides, our American guests really like that perspective, because it kind of gives them that, you know, that view of what, as an American, you might experience if you were to move to that city and experience it.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about food tours with Kenny Dunn. Kenny started doing food tours about 15 years ago when he moved to Rome. And today his company, Eating Europe, offers tours in 20 different European cities. When are you most welcome? Because I can think of going to I did a food tour in Porto in Portugal with a wonderful market there. And it's very crowded. It's beloved. And the food tour company made a point to go at an off hour where we could get the attention of the artisans and the entrepreneurs that would actually have a little sardine spread for us, waiting for us, and a little table and eight stools. And he'd entertain us for 15 minutes. But he couldn't do that at some times. Do you have to jockey around their schedules?
Yeah, you absolutely. I mean, it's very much a partnership. Many of the vendors, our food partners we've been working with for 8 or 9, 10 years, depending on the city. And it's exactly that, trying to do it so that, you know, it works for them and works around kind of their regular local customers. And like you said, in Porto, the magic is when you can integrate them into the tour, when they can explain.
And we got to remember those artisans, those merchants, their dad or mother probably had that same stall. This is their bread and butter. This is their passion. They care, to be honest, I would imagine, about their local clientele. And they're not going to compromise that for some food tour with a bunch of Americans looking for a sardine, you know. On the other hand, if there's a time where they could work it in, it's great. It's a little good business for them. And it's a wonderful way to share the culture.
Absolutely. And some of them, you do have to remember, I mean, we visit a butcher in Rome named Cesare. I mean, he never had tourists visiting him. And there we are telling his story, talking about his father and his grandfather. We show a photo when he was 6 years old, standing next to his dad. So for him, it was the first time he was actually getting those tourists. So, you know, it can work in those ways as well.
One thing about Americans is we don't have this rich love of traditional food, regional food, seasonal food, grandma's food, quite as vividly and enthusiastically as a lot of cultures. And it's just great to experience it, whether you're on a food tour or not. You go to a vineyard or you go to a winery, and you've got this man who's been giving people samples of his wine for 40 years, and he's doing it with the same gusto he did when he started, just because people love their food culture. I'm wondering, Kenny, I'm always European-centric. Is this a global thing? Are there as many food tours in the Pacific Rim or in Africa or, you know, Latin America?
It's definitely global. There are food tours on every continent with the exception of maybe Antarctica. Yeah. But I think, you know, they are for sure more popular and more prominent in North America, Europe, and Asia than, let's say, Africa or Latin America or South America, let's say.
It's part of my routine when I go to a place. I just want to have a food tour for many reasons. I get to know a local person. I learn about the food, which helps me in my research. I learn skills for enjoying that culture for the rest of my visit. And I connect with these artisans. So when I'm going to a new country, if I'm interested in experiencing the food culture, let's say I'm going to Morocco or I'm going to Costa Rica or I'm going to Japan, how would I learn about food tours? Where do you look?
Well, looking for food tours, I think it's like looking for a lot of the other kind of activities and experiences you may be searching for on your vacation. You know, you're going on Google, you're reading food blogs, podcasts these days, as well as guidebooks, of course.
I'm going to list a city, and I'm just going to ask you to say, when I say the city, if you were going to start up a company, a tour there, what you'd be sure to have? What would be the ideal food stop, all right? Just really fun. This, I mean, really, really quick and easy. Amsterdam.
Dutch apple pie. And there's a place called Cafe Pop Island that's been open since 1652, serving that apple pie.
Dutch apple pie. I love it. London.
London, I'm going to take you to a place called Bagel Bake, which is in the East End. We talked about the East End. And it's the last remaining bagel shop from when that neighborhood used to be a Jewish neighborhood.
And your guide would probably give you the Jewish heritage.
Absolutely.
And they would, I think I know the place, it's always mobbed. And your guide would know how to come at the right time and get to cut the line and say, I got 8 people up front.
It is open 24 hours.
That's great.
7 days a week.
Barcelona.
Barcelona, I'm going to introduce you to a bomba, which is a potato croquette filled with a pork ragu with the potato brava sauce on top.
Is that different than a croquetta?
Yeah, much bigger. Much more. It's almost a meal in itself.
Oh, that's great. What's it called again?
A bomba.
Bomba. Rome.
Rome, oh man. Probably supli. So a fried risotto ball filled with mozzarella.
It sounds like it's similar to the thing
Very
you just
similar,
about.
Yeah. Maybe because I was thinking bomba, but they're both two of my favorites.
Paris.
Paris, I'm going to introduce you to something which is the marriage of a croissant and an éclair.
Huh.
And it's phenomenal. It's at a place called L'Éclair de Genie. Mm-hmm. And this one pastry chef came up with this combination, and it's just to die for it.
You know, I took a food tour in Paris, and just a simple croissant was such an education to hear somebody who really knows what makes a good croissant.
Because croissants are going to be part of your French experience, whether you like it or not. It's breakfast.
Yeah.
And to know a good one, because you got bakeries that get the croissant of the year in Paris, and it's for real.
Oh, yeah.
And if you go to that, if you have a croissant there, you go, oh, now I get it.
Yeah. And to me, a food tour, some of it is discovering new foods, and some is going and, you know, you already have in mind that iconic food and you're getting one of the best versions of it.
Cannoli is a good example.
Exactly.
Cannoli can be horrible.
Yeah.
But if you go to Sicily and do go to a great place, cannoli, baby. Absolutely. You look like right now I'm looking at you and you just kind of, do you need a moment alone here? Okay, Athens.
Athens, there's a place where you can learn how to make your own gyro, Slovakia gyro.
Oh, that's, yeah, like a
lamb meat.
Lamb meat in a greasy bun.
Pita.
With a little bit of salad and sauce, right?
Right. Tomatoes, some tzatziki sauce.
I love that. That was my go-to when I was a teenage backpacker.
Oh, yeah.
I just called it a souvlaki.
Yeah.
But what's the real name?
No, souvlaki. Yeah.
That's it.
But souvlaki, in the States, you would know it as a gyro or gyro.
There you go. Okay,
gyro.
Good. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, so good.
And to know, there's a good example. You would have your food expert, your food guide, and everybody's going to have a souvlaki. It's the only thing you can have a $3 lunch. Here you go. You know, but you'll know the differences, the fine points.
And how to tell a good one from a knockoff.
Lisbon.
Lisbon, I mean, another great example. You think about Portugal, you think of custard tarts, right? Pastel de nata.
Oh, pastel de nata.
But to go to a place that makes 7,000 a day and you taste how fresh and different and to learn about the little things you can look for, like when it's caramelized on top. And that's what you take away, not just the flavor, but you know how to choose the right one as you go throughout your
I believe the pastel de nata is becoming trendy in London right now. I've noticed
See a lot of them in London.
But it's not the same. It's not the
same.
Which place are you thinking of in Lisbon when you closed your eyes and smiled?
There's a place called Mantegaria, which is in Lisbon. And
it's
like
up
I
there
said,
in the Barrio Alto.
Yeah. And they make like...
And they just crank them out.
Crank them out. And you could see them making them right in front of you.
You got 50 of them coming out of the oven every 5 minutes.
And that's fun, too, to see them filling up the little cups.
That's my go-to spot right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kenny Dunn's joining us from his home in Rome right now on Travel with Rick Steves to clue us in on the growing number of food tour options that can help orient us to cities as we travel. Kenny founded Eating Europe back in 2011 and now has a team of guides offering food tours in nearly 24 cities from Reykjavik to Athens. Kenny also weighs in on where to find the best fish and chips in London and the best beer in Prague and Dublin. Look for his blog posts at eatingeurope.com. This is so fun to be able to just bounce ideas off of you and for you to share your joy with us. I'm just going to mention a few memorable moments I've had on food tours, and I'd like to get your take on it.
Sure.
Okay, tin can cuisine in Portugal. What is that? You go to a restaurant and everything's out of a little sardine
can. And they're so beautiful, right?
It's a work of art.
They're work of art. Yeah, you can bring them home and just keep them on your shelf just as for decoration. So that is something definitely to check
Portuguese, out. Portuguese, you got to. Humble Crumble, London.
Humble Crumble. They've got two locations. They make the most beautiful, speaking of decorative, gorgeous, the most beautiful crumbles, little pies, and they're just a work of art.
Is it a one-off at the Spitalfields Market?
In Spitalfields and one in the Borough Market.
Okay, so
go to either.
Humble Crumble. I'm sort of skeptical about these trendy cupcake kind of places, you know, but this, Humble Crumble, it's sort of like a layer cake of sweet delights that just goes. If you like berry crumble and you like yogurt and oh baby, cheese plates in France.
Yeah, I mean the cheese in Paris or really anywhere in France. I mean it's just on another level. I mean to go into some of these cheese, well you can go into a cheese shop and take it away, or obviously sit down in a restaurant.
I love when a food guide comes out because they have a whole platter.
You know,
everybody's waiting anxiously out in the street. And then your guide comes over and she goes, there's three different kinds. You get to this, that, and this, and don't miss the gorgonzola and this one.
And when it's done well, they kind of guide you through it. Yeah. I want you to start with this, then
exactly.
That.
Sauerkraut in Vienna.
Mm. Vienna doesn't have too much street food, but the bratwurst with the sauerkraut.
In the Nosh Market, there's a guy who does sauerkraut. He's got all these old barrels, these wooden barrels, and he calls them vitamin balm. Here, have a vitamin balm.
There's nothing healthier than some sauerkraut.
Except a macaroon in Paris.
Yeah.
healthier for your attitude, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm not into gross food, but I had brains in Marrakesh. And
how was that?
I think I got sick the next day.
I thought you could say you had brains in Marrakesh.
For the rest of my life? Exactly. I mean, I'll do it. I'll take it. And what about alcohol? What's a fun alcohol, alcoholic drink?
Let's go back to Portugal, ginginha.
Perfect, because ginginha is a cultural experience also.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a little hole in the wall that has people who look like they've spent their whole life in a little hole in the wall drinking some sweet cherry wine or
something. Some colorful characters at the ginginha shop.
Ginginha. So these are all examples of slices of cultures, insights into cultures, and you can get it in a number of ways. The most important thing, I think, is to have that attitude that I want to try something new. I just want to get out of my comfort zone. I don't need to like it. I just want to try it. And then what's your batting average? Maybe you're batting 400. Okay, 4 out of 10 nibbles you'll love and you'll go back for the rest of your life.
I find most people are batting like 800.
800.
Yeah, really, you try these things and you come away and you're like, wow, I can't believe I liked it, but I did.
Or I can't believe I've been coming here for years and I never tried percebes.
Yeah.
Barnacles in
or
Portugal.
Lampredotto.
Lampredotto.
The four stomach in Florence.
Okay, Kenny Dunn, thanks so much. And I was going to say happy travels, but I'm just going to say buon appetit.
Buon appetito.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Casimir Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website, and our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You can find links to our guests and listen to a podcast version of the show or search the archives. It's all at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Monday Night Travel. It's a weekly travel party, and you're invited. Zoom in and have some fun learning about Europe's art, history, culture, and food over drinks and snacks. It's free, it's an adventure, and be careful, it can be addictive. Join me and my travel buddies over Zoom for Monday Night Travel. We're live every week, starting at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Eastern. Register at ricksteves.com and BYOB.